accession number 9338, reel 8.
Doug Turner, tape 8.
After following this experience, of course, I began to look forward to having my own truck. This happened soon after, and in no time I found myself becoming an experienced roadman.
What was your job? What did you actually do? You know, as a truck driver, would that have been when you say you had your own truck? What would your crew have been? Would you have had a companion with you?
This varied according to the size of the convoy. Occasionally there might be as many as 6 trucks on the road together, working as a single convoy, maybe 3 or 4, maybe 2, sometimes just a single truck, according to its where it was going and what it was carrying. But always we took a Chinese mechanic with us, whether we were a large convoy or whether we were just on our own.
What were you mainly carrying? You know, was it still medical supplies, drugs, that sort of thing?
Yes, there were drugs and medical equipment. These would go to the hospitals in Free China.
Did you find you had to guard it quite carefully?
Oh yes, indeed. Usually we had no problems, but always, of course, there was always the danger of being attacked. On one occasion, two of our members that had problems on the road and broken down, and they went to get help, and they were attacked by an armed gang, and one of them was certainly quite badly wounded, had his arm slashed through with a sword, and they managed to defend themselves with their water bottles, but of course his arm even now is still largely useless. On another occasion, a convoy was attacked and held up by boulders being placed across the road, and the armed gang then swooped down and took them prisoner and took over the whole of their supplies. And that was, I think, being the armed gang being largely the local warlord.
Because was it the case that the goods you carried, you know, the drugs and medical supplies, these would have had great value on the black
market?
Indeed,
they did. Drugs such as the sulfur drugs were regarded as a currency. They were never used, in fact, for their intention at all. They were just used as currency on the black market.
Did you have many problems regarding fuel?
Yes, we did. In the earlier days, they'd had to convert most of the trucks to charcoal-burning vehicles, and this certainly brought its very real scope of problems, and the early pioneers are full of wonderful stories of their experiences. Nevertheless, they always reached their destination. But the hazards were quite enormous. But then we managed to convert our vehicles also to using local fuels. This might range from wood alcohol to Gansu petrol from the far north, all low-grade fuel. But, of course, as the war ended, then more supplies began to come in, and at times we would get given large consignments of aeroplane high octane. This again meant dilution of this fuel with lower grades until we found the right the right balance. So again, we found ourselves constantly chasing, changing jets or altering our timing, with inevitable results upon the engine.
You've shown me some of the photographs of these incredibly bendy roads, you know, one with 24 bends and another with 70-odd. When you set out on these convoys, you know, in such terrain, it must have been a tremendous adventure. You know, what was it actually like? You know, did you have to get out and push? And did you have to, you know, did you have crashes?
Well, anything which could happen always happened. Rare were the days when we didn't get a full load of problems. The most common, of course, being burst tyres and fuel problems, broken springs, anything which could occurred. It's quite a strain on the nerves at times. But at the same time, there was the constant challenge of not knowing what was going to happen next. You could take over a truck and everything might be fine, but the uncertainty was always present. It was always better to have be in a convoy together, because you could then use one another to vent your spleen upon. But when you had nothing but the truck, then you didn't get so much satisfaction from it. But venting our spleen on one another certainly paid dividends.
Were you yourself ever involved in bandit attacks, you know, anything like that?
I wasn't involved in an actual bandit attack. I had a very uncomfortable experience after I'd had a headlong smash with a Chinese Army heavy vehicle, and my vehicle had been wholly smashed up. And I...
How did that happen?
Well, I was a part of a convoy, and I happened to be in the leading truck, and we just finished having our lunch, and we'd left the little town we'd eaten in, and I was just beginning to climb the next range of mountains again. As I turned round the first bend, a huge Army 6x6 belted straight into me, head on. Usually most Army vehicles had terrible drivers. They had no idea of how to control a vehicle other than hold the steering wheel and put their foot in the accelerator. And coming down hills, it was their usual practice to turn off the fuel and just glide down. This was, of course, in order to save fuel or else to sell the fuel. And there was no control over the vehicle at all. And fortunately, I'd just changed gear and was going moderately slowly, beginning to enter the incline, so that whilst my truck took the worst of the collision, I myself got away unscathed, but the driver and his mate in the other vehicle just hit their windscreens and knocked themselves out. It was a bit of a shock, but I managed to haul them out of the vehicle and dressing their wounds with my medical kit when the rest of the convoy came up. This led to quite an experience, because the Chinese Army held me responsible for the accident, and we found ourselves almost held to ransom. Resulting in a long argument with the Army Major, in which he ordered us to travel back by our convoy and pick up other supplies of his along the roadside. Reluctantly, we agreed to do this, but when we arrived there, we found that the things he wished us to pick up were ammunition, and this we refused to do. This led to a great loss of face on his part, and he then passed over the the ongoing discussions to his lieutenant, who a very polite and courteous young man, but nevertheless found himself involved with a wild-looking bearded foreigner who refused to cooperate. It's a long, long story and too long to go into now, but it ended up with them taking one of our drums of fuel and we having to accept this situation. Later on, I had to be left with my truck, obviously, on the roadside, whilst the rest of the convoy went on. And although most of the stay was quite pleasant, sitting on the mountainside during the day and sleeping on the truck at night, it ended up in one rather frightening episode when, in the middle of the night, I was raided by two men who took my money. And although I rather foolishly gave chase to them in the up the mountainside, I suddenly realised the futility of this and returned a sadder, wiser and rather frightened man.
It's interesting what you were saying, you know, how you were asked to take ammunition and refused. Was this policy that you would not take certain things? Because I was wondering how difficult this made your job, bearing in mind the strength of the army in that area.
Yes, it did indeed make it very difficult, but I felt that certainly this was a straightforward issue. We were forbidden to carry anything anyway apart from medical supplies, other than commercial goods, which are, the resources of which, of course, went into our funds. But this was a completely different situation altogether. I think this sort of thing inevitably arose in the circumstances in which we worked. And each of us had to find our own solution to it. There's no set answer.
How about picking up soldiers? You know, if you had an empty truck.
Yes.
And
yes.
There were soldiers who thumbed a lift.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you do in that
officially
situation?
Officially, we were unable to carry soldiers at all, but not infrequently. Of course, we were perforce had to. If they jumped on and refused to get off, then they just clung on, as some of them did, by the skin of their teeth, so to speak. Then there was little else we could do about it. As soon as we took one off, another one would climb on. And this did occur at times, but it was our policy not to carry them, but we didn't carry them in the normal way. But when you're up against situations like this, we don't carry them willingly, they just pile on.
It would seem to me that there was tremendous potential in this situation for the use of force on your part. Did this ever happen?
Oh, yes, indeed.
No, were pacifists forced into the situation?
Yes, we were. These were one of the issues which constantly faced us, and as individuals we had to find our own answer. There was one occasion where I think one of the unit members found this more than he could take, and it resulted in him leaving the unit. This was accepted because we were all in a similar position at times. It's a question, I suppose, of at some levels of humanity versus principle, because one did feel terribly sorry for these men in the army, in the forces. They'd been conscripted, they were simple people, many of them mere children, begging for lifts, barefooted, looking at us endlessly roaring past in our vehicles, room on the running boards for them to stand. Why wouldn't we give them a lift? And it's not that we didn't understand at all, but once we accepted that, then there was no end to it. Then we would become just part of the whole military system.
I was wondering, when you chased the two robbers, you know, who took your purse, your money, had you caught them, you know, would you have been forced, do you think? What were you going to do with them?
I was in an impossible situation. I think, looking back at the time, my act was an impulsive act generated by my own fear. I have no doubt about that. Looking back, I was in a state of high tension, and in my chasing them, it was I was trying to convince myself that I wasn't afraid. Of course, I was afraid. I suddenly realised, as I was climbing up into the mists, how foolish I was, and it was just giving away to my own pride that I wasn't really afraid when I was scared stiff. Had I met them, of course, I'd have been in an impossible situation. I could have done nothing whatsoever. It was a foolish act generated, as I say, wholly by my own real fear.
The other thing that interested me was when you said this officer, how he lost face. Was this a very important Chinese characteristic which you had to learn to deal with? The business of face.
Yes, this could be very embarrassing at times, and there were times, of course, when quite unintentionally we would cause Chinese people to lose face. Very often they forgave us and understood us, and realising that we were but mere barbarians. In cases such as this, well, this was a direct confrontation over an important issue. At least I felt it so. It would have been much easier, of course, to have abided by their expectations that we picked up this small box of ammunition and carried it.
You were talking about the army, you know, this relationship with the army. This would have been mainly the nationalists, would it?
Of course, yes.
The Kuomintang.
Yes, of course. There were no communists in that area.
What sort of state were they in, would you say? What sort of outfit was it in West China? Was it, for instance, a well-disciplined, organised force?
No, I think it was largely a rabble. The Kuomintang armies were quite ill-disciplined, poorly fed, poorly shod, poorly clothed. In fact, there was the common belief that they were soldiers during the day and might well be bandits by night.
Was there also any corruption in the army?
I think it was generally accepted that corruption was very widespread indeed. Yes, indeed.
And how did this relate to the Kuomintang government, you know, the nationalist government? Because I understand the army and government links were very tight. Is that right?
Oh, yes. On the other hand, although the government was nominally in charge of the military forces, of course, as I've already indicated with the local rebellion in Yunnan, when I first landed in China, they were very much a law unto themselves in the provinces, and there was constant tension going on as the people at the various top levels competed for power.
How about the mass of people in West China? What sort of state did they live in?
As they'd done for centuries, I imagine. Poor, largely, and more concerned with struggling to live.
Were they very poor?
Well, of course, it's varied. I mean, there are always the usual different levels of classes. The merchant class, who usually looked after themselves very well, and the peasant class and the labouring classes. And it's awfully difficult to convert living social life in China as we understand it in the West. The comparisons are not really don't really exist, other than perhaps to look at our own history in the medieval times. I mean, China was a medieval country, living in very much as we must have lived 600-700 years ago.
What would the state of welfare have been in China? You know, was there any system of medical care, education, that sort of thing?
Well, of course, China's always supposed to have had a cultured and educated class, and to some extent this did certainly exist. Some of the students, for example, were exceedingly well educated, and this, coupled with their long culture, certainly reflected a deep tradition of living.
How about the mass of the people that you saw as you went on your long journey through the little villages?
I think one of the most impressive things one discovered about China was that no matter how poor people were, that this culture still remained. It wasn't just a veneer. There was something about them which gripped one. Their resistance to their conditions, or rather their acceptance of their conditions, impressed one tremendously. This tremendous resilience of the people of China. It could only be perhaps be experienced. It was there. Tremendous acceptance of the situation in which they were. At the same time, of course, a growing awareness of the injustice of it all.
These drugs you were, taking about in your convoys, was there an obvious need for them, so far as you
Very, very
see?
Much so. And of course, it's very important that we did our best to see that they went to the most reputable people, and of course it did. And many of them were mission hospitals, some of them were government hospitals. But in most cases, if not all cases in which we were concerned, that the drugs were rightly used and very much welcomed, of course.
What was the health of the people like? You know, were there signs of obvious disease in the civilization?
Yes. I mean, wherever one went, I mean, there was poverty and ill health, dysentery, smallpox, all the tropical diseases. One can think of an underdeveloped country.
Did you see signs of goiters? You know that.
There were certain areas of China where there was much iodine deficiency and a great need there. I believe that the present authorities have taken very, very active steps towards coping with that.
How about eye disease?
There was everything there of all sorts, yes. It's almost impossible to talk about. I mean, it was so widespread.
You mentioned the missionaries. Could I now ask you about the missionaries that you met in this part of China? Were there many of them to begin with?
Well, of course, there had been for many, many years missionaries working in China, and most of them, of course, are very deeply committed people. One might not always agree with their particular theology. And undoubtedly amongst them there were those who tended to develop an arrogance towards the peoples of the country. But on the other hand, there were those who were certainly most deeply committed to their cause and the people. We were on friendly terms with all of them, and they used to welcome our visits.
Can you remember any missionaries in particular?
Yes. One got to know some of them quite intimately. There were the Lutheran Sisters of Bijie in China. And they'd been there many, many years, and German-speaking origin, and they were very, very close friends of the unit and used to give us a thoroughly warm welcome with huge breakfasts when we arrived with supplies. And there was a deep, ongoing relationship and respect for one another. Much singing and joy indeed. And Catholics, of course, were scattered over the whole country. Very often these priests are being utterly alone, there for years and years on end, and I became quite firm friends with one or two of them. One of them, a German priest, Father Tempelmeyer, who had been out there for some 15 years, I believe, making converts at the rate of perhaps five a year. But we became very, very warm friends indeed, although we, again, would have long discussions going into the night. He really, most enthusiastic person. Others perhaps were, tended to be a little more emotive towards their beliefs. But at the same time, one must respect their concern for the people they worked amongst, and one can well understand the feeling of shame which came upon many Chinese when the missionaries were driven out by the new regime.